Thursday in New York City. Thursday in New York City. I can't hear myself. Maybe you can hear me. Yeah, there we are. Beautiful day. December. It feels like springtime around here. Did we forego Hanukkah, Christmas, Easter, and skipped right to spring? I wish I could sometimes, but again, holidays are pretty cool. Happy Hanukkah to our listeners. And anyone who's celebrating Christmas, if you started shopping, I hate you. I'm kind of a last-minute guy. The show is Insight. Thursdays right here on the PRN Network, Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Lots of great, compelling topics today. We're going to be talking about a gentleman we've, of course, unfortunately heard about so many people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And since its opening in 1937, more than 2,000 people have plummeted to their death. Crazy. But this man, Kevin Hines, survived. What about good deeds? Lots of good deeds to talk about. Holidays, exchanging gifts, materialism everywhere, coworkers, bosses, where does it stop? Drugs and alcohol. I just spoke recently at Princeton Disability Awareness Conference. Yes, at Princeton University. I was so stoked to be invited to speak there. A lot of fun. And, you know, we always have to, when you're a parent, you have to have that talk. You know, having a talk with a kid years ago meant just like the birds and the bees. And, of course, you know, watch out for Chester the molester, molestation. I laugh about it, but it's not funny. You know, appropriate behavior. Now you have to throw in some other things. School shootings. How do you approach your children about things of this without putting the fear of God in them? Right? My Lord. All these things coming up right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Love to hear where our most remote listeners are tuning in today. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, or shoot me an email at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com, mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. I know we have listeners overseas all the time, and I'd love to see this morning, or wherever you are, whatever your time difference may be, wherever you're located, and say hello to you. So I heard about this news. It actually happened in October, but it really got into the news cycle not too long ago. And I want to talk to you about it because as a speaker that goes into schools all the time, I just was really taken aback by this news piece. The National Education Association President Lily Garcia, she faces a lot of backlash for comments about special needs students. I mean, this is a very, very sensitive area. So you really have to, you know, walk on a very, very thin ice, use kid gloves, handle with kid gloves. I mean, very, very sensitive area. If you have a child or if you work in this area, you are very, very aware of the sensitive and delicate vernacular alone. So during the Campaign for America's Future Awards Gala in October, Garcia said something that we're going to play for you in a little while, but just want to give you a little bit of background about it because the American Association of People with Disabilities, otherwise known as AADP, and many other organizations are really upset, calling for the resignation of Lily Garcia, the NEA president, National Education Association. Education world is just full of acronyms, right? I think it's one of these organizations that just, or one of these industries that you just have to need a short sheet to keep straight of everything that's going on there. So it's very interesting that someone who's at the head, the leader of an organization, of an education association, would be so callous to use inappropriate vernacular when addressing whoever she needs to be addressing. I'm in a chair right now that keeps sliding down. So I'm going to try to fix this, but I keep sliding down like every few seconds, another inch or two. So let's see if we can get through the show. Otherwise, I'm going to flop chairs. But I love these chairs. I was just saying to my producer, Jesse, how awesome these chairs are. So anyway, so we're going to play the clip. And this is where she's kind of introducing herself and her job, and she leads into it. Now, it goes by very quickly. So wherever you are, whatever you're listening to, your iPhone, any digital medium, source, computer, whatever, turn it up and listen closely. It's going to happen in the first 10, 15 seconds what she says. And we'll discuss it afterward and maybe possibly play that portion again, and I'll read you the actual clip. But pay particular attention to the first 20 seconds. We're going to play you a longer clip just to get an idea of the context of how she used it. And we're going to hear this right now. This is the NEA president, Lily Garcia.
Public school. I'm an educator. It's up to me to educate the man in the middle seat as much as to educate a politician about what happens in any given typical school on any given typical day. I mean, we serve kids a hot meal. We put Band-Aids on boo-boos. We diversify our curriculum instruction to meet the personal and individual needs of all of our students, the blind, the hearing impaired, the physically challenged, the gifted and talented, the chronically tarded, and the medically annoying. We make sure that they've had their immunizations, make sure they understand disease control, teach them to resist drugs, alcohol, tobacco. We give career counseling, pregnancy counseling, mental health counseling. We get them on the bus safely. We take them off the bus safely. We provide computer instruction, sex education. We stop bullying, teach them to say, I'm sorry, and mean it. We instill an understanding of civil rights, the political process, challenge racism, foster social tolerance, tolerance and appreciation for our cultural and religious diversity. We teach the principles of free enterprise, how to be a good sport. We develop personal responsibility, practice bicycle safety, and check for head lice. We provide bilingual education, teach metrics, how to be a wise consumer, exercise, weight control, how to drive a car. We teach the impact of wars, develop collaborative skills, how to tune a violin, how to use reason and evidence to protect the future. We teach them to revere their environment, how to manage their money, how to access information, how to make wise choices, how to balance a checkbook. We teach loyalty to the ideals of a democracy. We build patriotism, good oral hygiene, and respect for the worth and dignity of every individual. We nurture curiosity, encourage a good question, build self-esteem, and then we teach reading, writing, and arithmetic.
So I imagine you're not joining in on applause right there. Again, that's NEA President Lily Garcia, and this took place back in October during a Campaign for America's Future Awards where she presented. Now I'm going to read the most important paragraph here. And first of all, my second thought is that, you know what? All those things she listed are so paramount, but that's what teachers do. That's their job. If we listed all our job responsibilities in the title of each position we have, because some people have multiple titles at the workplace, I'm sure they would be equally impressive, except, of course, that we're impacting America's youth. And I don't undermine that at all. The importance of that is significant. Now, going back to her quote, quote, we diversify our curriculum, instruction to meet the personal individual needs of all our students, the blind, the hearing impaired, the physically challenged, the gifted and talented, the chronically tarded, and the medically annoying, end quote. So, and she even punched the line medically annoying. So for her to use this tone, these words are just unfathomable. Now, I would imagine she either A, wrote this herself, or B, had someone write it for her, a speechwriter. I'm sure the NEA has a nice, lavish budget. And so usually a speech of this caliber is either written by someone else or co-written. But the point is that she would have to proofread it, especially when she was doing that delivery style. She was doing it very fast, and she was picking up her pace, her cadence, et cetera, to make a point about all that teachers do in the United States to educate our children. So how could someone not come across those four different words, chronically tarded, medically annoying, and not put up a red flag to say, you know what, I question this because I think this doesn't sound too PC. And if even if the worst case scenario, you would say, you know what, maybe we're going to piss off some people. Maybe we shouldn't say chronically tarded or medically annoying. And if they didn't question that, which they did, if they didn't, it wasn't enough to take it off the pages of her script, that's even worse. And I could possibly understand if she's speaking extemporaneously, no script, and sort of misspoke and caught herself and corrected herself right there on the fly, on the spot. But again, no, I go back to my point that these were carefully chosen words and examples of things they should be lauded for. I don't understand it. So the American Association of People with Disabilities, again, the AAPD, released a statement condemning comments made by the president, Lily Garcia, regarding students with disabilities. Of course, they want to meet with her. They want to open a dialogue. They certainly need to educate her about sensitivity training, the proper vernacular. I speak in front of challenged populations all the time because I'm visually impaired. And one of the things when I speak at schools K through 12 and colleges and universities, it's the mainstream audiences, combined audiences, and just to challenge audiences. So choosing the right words is so gargantuan because, number one, I don't want to offend anyone. And when you're in a diverse, I should say, audience, you have to be extra, extra careful, as everyone knows nowadays, due to the fact that you're probably being recorded. If not, your words will certainly go out on some feed, Twitter feed, some social media platform. And that shouldn't be the driving force why you speak properly in the context of an audience, because you want to, right? Just like anything in life, you have to prepare and practice and know your audience. That's the biggest thing about speaking, is knowing your audience. So anyway, I want to read you some comments on social media because it was a buzz. I don't have the names of the people, and it's not really important right here, but one of the quotes says, "I think her gaffe is actually a big part of the problem in education today. There are a lot of people in power, both on a local and national level, that are woefully lacking in education about people with disabilities and how to teach in varied student body." So very true. Another one, "They're chronically tarded and then medically annoying. This is who they have running the show. Someone who used retarded is an insult, a joke. This person is supposed to speak for the needs of special needs student. ? Another quote, "This is why I cyber school my son. Our district failed him. No offense, but I'm glad the cyber school is taking money out of the NEA's pockets." End quote. So, and there's a whole string of things. So actually, this is an article, and the video is available on themighty.com, themighty.com. It's a great website, actually. Their tagline is, "We face disability, disease, and mental illness together." Again, that's themighty, M-I-G-H-T-Y.com. You can Google her name, Lily Garcia, NEA, National Education Association, and all this will come up, and much more. But it just boggles my mind that this person is at the helm of the Education Association. She should be so well refined, so polished, so skilled in making comments to any audience, parents, educators, politicians, Congress, whatever the case may be, and using the right words, not offending anybody. Sensitivity training. I mean, it just boggles my mind. What else can you say? I just don't understand how she can get away with it. Some people are calling for her head on a platter, or at least they'll settle for her stepping down. I don't know. It's a very, very powerful organization. Love to hear your feedback at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888, because obviously you don't have to have a child with a disability. Or even if you have a disability, this could possibly, you know, rock your world. I have a visual impairment. It's a different disability than what she was talking about, but maybe not really. I fall into the medically annoying. I could be considered medically annoying because I would need accommodation in school. Couldn't see the chalkboards at all. Took longer to read. Needed untimed tests, things of that nature. So I could fall into the medically annoying aspect. So as a parent, if I had a child with a disability, I would have blown my stack and certainly would partake in some sort of reform, some sort of dialogue in this case to make sure something of this caliber doesn't happen again. And I'm sure that and this happens all the time, everyday conversation, but there's a difference. These people who are making gaffes aren't the leaders of education associations. Well, we hope not. And we understand that. We have to give people some, you know, some slack because we can't say that people are ignorant. You're ignorant, I think, if you know better. But if you're not educated in using the proper vernacular terms, words, etc., you're just insensitive and you just don't know. But when you educate somebody and then they still, you know, choose not to use the proper terminology, then it would be ignorance. But certainly a person of this caliber, it's really inexcusable. Again, that's 888-874-4888. That's Lily Garcia. A lot of backlash for her comments about the special needs population, and this is during the Campaign for America's Future Awards gala in October. Not sure where it took place. It's kind of irrelevant. But again, for her to say the chronically tarded and the medically annoying, and it went on from there, is just, again, it's unfathomable. And I guess my final point again is that I don't give educators by any means any, which I should say, they get my complete respect. They have a very hard job capturing attention, keeping their attention, and sculpting these young minds, keeping them interested in a way where they can be smarter than they were, more enhanced, more enlightened, when they come out of your schoolroom, whether it's 6 months later or 10 months later, because it's pivotal. No matter what age, they're there for a reason, to receive an education. And it's a hard job. It's a hard job. But a lot of people have hard jobs. People have multiple bosses, deadlines, budgets they have to reach. And if they don't meet budgets, they're in probably hot water. Not probably, they can be in hot water. People lose their jobs all the time for underperforming or, you know, restructuring, et cetera, et cetera. and so the Education Association is not any different in terms of having it very difficult. But I guess what I'm trying to articulate is that when the head of an association, as powerful as this, says that, you know, they do all these different aspects in educating children, that's your job. And you should excel at it from the top all the way down to whatever teaching level there is. It's so very important. Preschool, you know, it's important. And we do thank you. We thank our educators all the time. I thank my any teacher for doing a great job. When I go into schools, I say, hey, thanks for what you're doing. Because they come to me and they're like, oh, great speech, great talk. You really empowered and motivated our kids, inspired them. I said, hey, how long have you been teaching? They're like, oh, a year, 5 years, 20 years. I said, hey, thank you. Thank you for doing what you do. Because I come in here and speak for an hour or two and I'm out the door. It's a piece of cake. Yeah, I'm showing a lot of vital information about my life, mistakes I made, things I wasn't able to do due to my visual disability, et cetera, and make them laugh and sprinkle kernels of very significant information between those points of laughter and or, you know, self-degrading mockery of myself. And that's my job. But to stay in the building, obviously, many, many days and educate students is a whole another thing. So I applaud teachers everywhere. This woman, Mrs. Garcia, has a lot of work to do, and the organization itself to restore confidence and or make sure nothing of this nature happens again. Again, this is coming from the top. So I imagine there's a lot of educators who are completely embarrassed by the person at the helm, Mrs. Garcia, who especially teachers in the special ed areas, that are probably shaking their head and say, how can a person of this caliber, our leader, our so-called boss, representative, be so naive? Yeah, and that's that. Kevin Hines, I mentioned him at the beginning of the show. This individual is remarkable on every level. At the young age of 19, after struggling with hearing voices, bipolar disorder, his life is just totally spiraling out of control. So he wrote himself a suicide note. He took a bus to the Golden Gate Bridge, and where he stood, I believe, and paced for about 40, 45 minutes or so. And there's bikers, there's walkers, there's tourists. As a matter of fact, one tourist actually came up to him and said, would you be so kind, I think it was in a thick German accent, to take my picture. And after he obliged, he actually even said, look, I don't even notice. People don't even really notice me. I'm not regarded. So it's a horrifying act to think about someone taking their life in general. but to take it in such a violent way. Men typically do it in more violent ways. By gun is most popular, by jumping from a high rise or from a building, etc., is often another typical way that people die by suicide. My brother chose the former as well. He jumped off a 40-story building, and that's a pretty brutal thing to have to live with. And when I read and heard about this story, it made me think about my brother. And this is a quote from Kevin Hines, because he survived the, you'll find out about this in a second, the 25-story jump. Quote, "The millisecond my hands left the rail, it was an instant regret. And I remember thinking that no one's going to know I didn't want to die. In 4 seconds, I fell 75 miles an hour, 25 stories, and I hit the water. I was in the most physical pain I had ever experienced," end quote. So a few things come to my mind. Number one, in the most pain he ever experienced, and I'd love to get Kevin on the show here because people who suffer from depression, vast, heavy-duty clinical depression, say there's nothing like it, nothing more scary, nothing more dark, nothing more painful. But I find his remarks right here. He does say physically painful, so that could be the distinction. Physically versus mentally painful, mental anguish. Because I remember my brother just saying, you know, this is such a dark place. He just was not himself. And then after, I've spoken about this before on the show, but just to refresh some of you, the PRN listeners, that I went through my own form of panic attacks, anxiety, and depression a couple years later after the death of my brother. And I knew, oh my God, that I would never take my life. For some reason, the wiring, the studies have shown that you're either predisposed and you can always see some positivity, some silver lining, which I was able to do, thankfully, even though I had incredible, intrusive suicidal thoughts, jumping in front of this subway train that was approaching, you name it, and it would rock my world, throw me into complete panic attacks. So the point is that what I was feeling was like an iota of what my brother and or Kevin Hines or the hundreds of thousands of people who suffer from depression, diagnosed or not, then I almost understand how they feel like they're a burden on people, and that I would be better off. They're not better off by any stretch of the imagination. But that's the thought. Because a lot of times, and I forget the medical term of this, that when people are clinically depressed, they feel they don't even have, they may have the thought, the desire, the idea to commit suicide, but they don't have the actual physical energy. Sounds weird, right? Sounds funny? Ironic. But sometimes when they start coming out of this darkness just a touch, they actually get the enough energy to say, okay, well, this is enough because I can't go back to that place again. So it's fascinating to read about Kevin Hines. And also Kevin Hines has a book called Cracked, Not Broken. And the good news is he's speaks with and works with a lot of mental health organizations nationally. He's married. And has struggled still to this day. But he's part of the less of than the 1% who have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. Less than 1%. And he shares his story in a powerful new video that you can find online. If you just Google Kevin Hines, I'm sure you'll see the video. And he hopes the experience, certainly was going to help other people help realize and seek help that suicide is not the answer. But it's crazy to think that he would be able to survive on such a fall. And he writes that it's okay not to be okay. I totally love this line because people feel like, oh my God, I'm damaged goods. And so was I. I was thinking like, oh geez, I'm going to end up like my brother when I was feeling panic attacks, anxiety, intense anxiety. And then it ultimately changes your brain chemistry and then you go into a form of depression. So when I came out of it, I'm like, it's okay not to be okay because you have to go to therapy, et cetera, and you find out more about yourself and how much of the brain they do know and don't know. But he's still in treatment, Kevin Hines. But he says it's not okay not to ask for someone to back you up. It's so true because, first of all, in anything in life, starting a new job, ending a relationship, having panic attacks, whatever the case may be, we all need advice from people in life, whether it's a professional relationship, someone who is a good friend, someone who is a mentor in life. But it really is great, and I applaud people for I always ask for help. Even if it's a simple thing like not a simple thing. I do a lot of major projects around my house. I have go-to people. I have go-to people in the radio industry about certain things. I have go-to people in the TV industry. We all have these people. And sometimes I'm the go-to people, certainly for others in their life. I mentor one or two people that are younger than me who are visually impaired. And also there's a member, a number of us who are visually impaired, some of them much worse than me, that we're always trading stories on and ideas and technological advances and or items that are out there that could certainly help us all. But my point is that it's not okay not to ask for someone to back you up. And that's in anything in life, certainly with mental health. And it's kind of cool that Kevin Hines is he's currently working on a film project called Suicide, The Ripple Effect, and certainly wants to continue raising awareness for those living with mental illness. And I believe this project that he's working on, they were able to set up a camera, which sounds pretty cool, on the Golden Gate Bridge that filmed all daylight hours. But the freaky thing is that they caught many, many suicides that were fatal. So here you are, and I guess that's what they were, their hopes were. I imagine they were hoping for not a sizable number, but I think there was some pushback on this. But the reality is that two things. Number one, if we're able to film suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge for a documentary, wouldn't we be able to either alert someone that maybe there's a police location, a small stand, you know, like a bridge operator has like a booth? Why wouldn't there be a booth somehow established, constructed on the bridge? Yes, I know it's a big span. And also they have agreed, and I don't remember the latest news on this because when I mentioned this, oh, probably last year sometime, they did agree, they did a study, feasibility study, on erecting barriers along the Golden Gate Bridge. But when they realized the tally, the cost, it was really, really costly. But can you put a price on life? So going back to my point, okay, so they were filming this, the Golden Gate Bridge, daylight hours for a year straight, 365 days straight. And I forget the number. It's not on my, I read it on a different piece. It's not on my notes here, but it was an alarming number of people who actually committed suicide. And I think they, one actually was interrupted. I'm not sure how that came into play, but thankfully one life was spared. So this will be used, obviously, for the content. I'm not sure what will be shown, how much will be shown, how graphic it'll be. I don't think it needs to be graphic at all. Just the fact that someone is actually pondering suicide. Usually people don't act normal. I don't know how Kevin, or if he could even recall how he acted, but hanging out for 40 minutes prior to putting his hands on the guardrail, handrail, and then leaping. So 40 minutes went by. That's a long time to sit idle and to consider taking your life. But the crazy thing is, and it's not crazy because I always wonder, like, when someone is in that much pain and they actually, like a gun, something that's fatal, there's no time for remorse unless for some reason you don't shoot yourself fatally, which is a good thing, to reconsider or say, oh my God, what am I doing? I can't die. I don't want to die. I'm trying it. Now I changed my mind. So this is what Hines did. I mean, as soon as he put his hand on the guardrail, he had an instant regret. So I wonder how many of those 2,000 people that certainly we can't ask had an instant regret as well. They didn't want to die after they realized, number one, how friggin' scary it is probably to leap off the building, I'm sorry, the railing of the Golden Gate Bridge, and many other reasons, it maybe puts things into perspective. His father was quoted saying that every time the phone rings, I think to this day, this is Kevin Hines' father, that he always, the worst always comes into his mind, that he feels like something happened to Kevin. But Kevin seems like he's totally on the right track. I applaud Kevin for sharing his story, for writing his book, and being part of this upcoming movie. Who knows the release date? But the again, the title will be Suicide, The Ripple Effect. So you can Google that and find out more information on that. So it's pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, this is a bridge, and also the George Washington Bridge, which is probably about, 6 miles from here, 8 miles from here, known for the same exact thing. I mean, any given day, this happens. There are signs on the George Washington Bridge that I'm actually happy to say that the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention was pivotal in lobbying the New York and New Jersey Port Authority, that says, I don't know exactly what it says, but something like, if you're considering, if you're feeling harmful thoughts, something along those lines, there's a number right there. So, and there's a phone, I believe. So it's not like they can put up a phone number and not have a phone. They'd have to stop somebody and say, hey, can I borrow your cell phone here? But so there are efforts and measures being taken, which is great. But and the bottom line is, the reality is, and I wouldn't be hired by an organization because they wouldn't want me to say this, but the reality is, if someone wants to take their life, you cannot stop them. You may be able to stop them today, tomorrow, next week, next month. But ultimately, people take their lives all the time in facilities, hospitals that are geared for this. Where there is a will, unfortunately, there is a way. That's the reality of it. Just, it's like bullying. You can't stop bullying, and there's that's an unfair comparison, but you understand the gist of what I'm trying to say. Human behavior, you can't stop somebody from doing something. Unfortunately, when someone is in such a distraught state, they're not in their right mind. So that's why education is pivotal. This is Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. We'll move on to less heavy material right after this.
This is PRN.FM. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
The story behind the story, your story, my story, is all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. This is Utrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Null's show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from PRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell this story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is journalist Dave Lindor. I'll be hosting the show This Can't Be Happening each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. Because we know it is happening, each week's program will feature some issue that's been getting ignored or misreported, like Social Security, climate change, military spending, or the government's destruction of the Internet. Please join me at This Can't Be Happening on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned.
I love that promo we play. We're the Progressive Radio Network, and we hope you're coming with us. You have no choice. We're going to tie you up. We're going to make you come with us. We're going to force you to never leave your smartphone, computer, never change it from PRN.FM. You got it? Would be heavy consequences to pay if you do. Insight is the show. Mark Farrell is your host. That would be me. Half crazy today. Not enough sleep. Up too early. A lot of other things that you don't want to hear. But this is one thing you want to hear. I was really happy to see the other day my son, who's 6 years old, in first grade, came home with a good deeds sheet. And I'm like, wow, this is very, very cool. It was a homework. Actually, it's still going on this week. And I imagine it's about 20 different boxes that he doesn't have to check all of them. But obviously, the more he checks, they're encouraged to do more things. And I was like, this is such a great thing to instill. On the heels of what we kind of talked about earlier, that the president of the National Education Association, this is a great example of all the good things that happen in school, which are endless. It's just, again, when the leader of an education association, oh, we won't go back there again. Because I said, we're going to move on and be positive. Yes, that's exactly right, because I am a positive nature guy. So it's great. So my son Luke comes home from school. He's got all these different boxes. So, for example, push in someone's chair, pick up something they drop, wave to someone you don't know, smile to someone, write a note to your teacher. Look up the sky. I'm just kidding. I'm keeping it clean. There's a whole slew of them. And it's great. So we go over these, and he had about 4 or 5 of them the first day, just because, thankfully, I'd like to say as parents, we've been teaching him to be a good person. It doesn't take a lot, right? I mean, you lead by example. As a matter of fact, he said holding the door open was one of the things he did. And wherever we go, I always hold the door open for, it doesn't matter the gender. And sometimes I say to Luke, would you mind getting that door for the gentleman or for that lady? Just to obviously get him into the habit of doing kind things and expecting nothing in return. So that's a great thing I'd like to see schools do. And help someone out, you know, sit with somebody new at lunchtime. He said he played with somebody new the other day at recess, which is cool. I was like, that's a great thing, because that kid probably may have been, you know, maybe not that happy that day. And he's going to go home possibly and say, hey, this kid came up to me and said, you want to swing or go down a slide? I'm like, you never will understand the power. And I put it in like sixth grade ease, but you'll never understand the power of making someone feel good, because you may not see it on their face. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, but they will go home and or the rest of their day will be changed because you gave them sort of a positive interaction. So he did make a card that night for his teacher that said something like, you know, thank you for all that you do, you rock, etc. And so he gave, and it actually did a nice illustration in there, exceeded my expectations. I was like, wow, that was pretty good. So he came home the next day. I said, hey, how'd you do? Did you give the card? He's like, yeah. I said, well, what happened? He said, well, she said, I made her day. And I said, that's great. Well, how did you feel? And he just lit up. He was beaming, totally beaming. He goes, I felt really good, Dad. I'm like, isn't that amazing? How doing something good for someone makes you feel even better. That's great. So it's a great example how to pay it forward, good deeds. And I said to him, Luke, this piece of paper that we have right here, I'm going to scan this, I'm going to save this, and we're going to put this on a refrigerator, because this isn't just for you or your three-year-old sister. It's for your mom, my wife, and for me, because I like to do a lot of these things every day. And I don't walk out the front door going, okay, I got to check 10 things off this list. This is just innately who I am. And we like to think on a grand scale, that's who we are as a human race. And obviously we know things different from culture to culture. I'll try that again. And that's totally understandable. Things are accepted. Things are done differently, etc. But in a whole sense, we like to treat people the way we want to be treated. Exactly. And that's a good segue into the holidays. The holidays. Yes, yes, yes. Where to begin? Oh, my God. Okay, where to begin? I guess Home Depot had that figured out, because they had holiday decorations up, I think, shortly after. It was either right before Labor Day or right after Labor Day. I had to pinch myself and said, wait a minute, did I was in a coma for a month or so, month and a half, 6 weeks? Anyway, it's just crazy. It's so materialistic. It's just crazy. And someone I know who's got a pretty big job said to me, you know, I got this new position and I have about, 20 people that report to me underneath in their management, and I'm going to take them out to lunch And I said, oh, okay, so you're going to where? And I said, oh, that's a nice restaurant. And I said, so how much is it going to be per person? Because, you know, you can't, some people may not want to spend whatever. I don't know what the price was. I'll say $30 or $50 a piece. And then this person said, no, 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 I'm going to pay for it. And I said, are you crazy? You're going to treat a staff of 20 people or so to lunch? That's really, really gracious and generous, and you have a heart of gold, and I think that's why you're admired and you do so well at work, because they know that you respect them and you want to obviously show how much you appreciate them. And that's we wish every boss could be like that. Every subordinate wishes they could have a superior like that. But the reality is you just can't spend that much money. So my question is, and the reason why I bring this up is that, you know, when is enough enough? What do you do? I mean, do you feel obliged to give your boss a present? I guess there's kind of two schools of thought, because you're happy that you have a job, but you're also realize that you do a good job. So maybe your boss should be appreciative that you make them look good, right? That would make sense. That was my philosophy. As a matter of fact, I have a funny story. I had a boss who would give some presents out very selectively. And I was like, whoa, man, she didn't give me a gift. And one year, and this could be a very true event for her, but she said to me, oh, Mark, you know, I ordered you a gift. And it's on, I forget what she said, Amazon or whatever. And it didn't arrive yet. But, you know, after the break, I'll give it to you. I'm like, oh, it's totally not necessary, but I really appreciate the generosity and the mention of that. And it's very kind of you. P.S. That gift never arrived. She never mentioned it, etc. So it's kind of funny, and it puts people in awkward situations because they feel compelled that they have to. And then there's the how much do I spend? That person gave me a gift I didn't expect them to. Do I reciprocate? I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gone out to the store for my wife because she's like, oh my God, this person gave me a gift and he's a guy. I have no idea. I'm like, all right, well, just tell me what he's kind of into. What does he do? I'll take care of it for you. But I've never been a big fan of buying my superiors lunch. Like, I did buy Gary Null a store once, though, so he could sell some health food items out of it. Now I'm just busting your chops. But Gary Null does a great thing here. I leave too early for this, but he treats this fantastic staff of his to lunch every day. Is that still happening, guys? I get a nod. Every day, I believe they can place an order. I'm not sure if there's a price limit, whether you can make an order for your entire family and bring it home in a to-go bag. Probably not. But that's a very gracious thing he does, Gary Null, as the owner of this network. That's very cool. I need to stay later and take him up on this. But does your boss do anything of that caliber all year long? Or is it just at the holidays? Or do they just not do squat for you? But what is the barometer? What is the template? I guess it varies from work environment and workplace to workplace. Because when I worked in radio full-time, terrestrial radio, I would get cash money. That's right, cash money, ladies and gentlemen. Love it. From the sales department. And it was sometimes very, very helpful. How can cash not be helpful? But sometimes it's very, very generous because, you know, salespeople make a lot of money. Depends on what industry. Radio sales, 5 years ago, they made good money. I'm not sure how well they're doing now with the digital medium out there. Knock, knock, in terms of internet radio, et cetera. There's money to be made. Certainly, it's different than what it was before. But I used to get a nice, big, fat envelope, and I used to be very, very happy with that because I provided them with a product that they could sell very easily and would make them look good because it made the station sound good as a win-win, et cetera, et cetera. So, but the question is, though, like, you know, what's the protocol? Do you get your boss a gift? Love to hear all about this. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And if you do get your boss a gift, do you feel like you have to do it every year? Or it's just because they gave you a gift 1 year and then they didn't reciprocate? You know, it gets kind of murky, man, right? It totally does. And do you get a gift for your colleague? But colleagues, I can understand because, you know, you're working together. And that's neat because you appreciate their company because, hey, everyone loves to be able to work with somebody they can consider a friend, a confidant as well. Maybe you're on a par level, you know, equal job positioning, et cetera. title-wise or even not. But it's just nice to work with somebody, no matter what industry you're in, that you can, you know, BS with, vent with, to, whatever the case may be. And, of course, you always want to maybe say to them, hey, let's agree to make a $20 price limit. Let's agree not to exchange gifts. As a matter of fact, let's make this very public right here. Because I'm starting to draft a Christmas list for all the PRN Insight listeners, only the, my show listeners, okay, Insight, what I would get each and every one of you. But I'm kind of running out of paper here. So let's make this, let's put this on the table right here, right now. Let's just decide right across the board, no exchanging gifts this year, okay? I can breathe. I can breathe and I can throw this list out because it's just getting lengthy already. I'm just going to have to get Jesse a gift who operates the controls, the engineer here. And let me see, Jason Tobenfeld, got to get him some good gifts, man, for his kids. Yeah, I got to hook some people up here. If you just tuned in, it's the Progressive Radio Network. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Let's move on to some nice drugs and alcohol talk.
That's what I'm talking about.
So one of the things I talk about when I go to schools is drugs and alcohol. And I'd say it's probably one of my more favorite talks because, number one, I can share just a crazy aspect of my past that people look at me and be like, no way. As a matter of fact, my wife knew me after I cleaned up my act, and she was like, I cannot believe you were that person. I'm like, sometimes I can't believe it. And actually, a sidebar to the story I'm about to tell is this weekend we had some friends over on Friday night and kind of overdid it with wine just because we don't drink that much. Then Saturday we had an opportunity to go out in the city here because my sister's moving to Chicago, so we kicked up our heels. We kicked up our heels so much that one of her friends said, this great darling couple said, hey, listen, we got an extra room. Why don't you stay over? You know, your kids are at your in-laws. You know, no need to rush home tonight. This way you can stay out later. P.S. at 4 a.m., we're putting our heads down on a pillow. I kind of remember that. But it made me remember all the craziness that ensued in my life for so many years. Of course, I wasn't going crazy and doing shots. Actually, I did buy. So I've gotten smarter as I gotten older because I did buy a round of 10 shots of tequila. And guess how many people were drinking? Actually, there were 11 people in this small group of people that we were with. I bought 10 shots. I was smart enough not to do that shot of tequila after having like a couple bottles of wine. So that was probably my saving grace for Sunday. But anyway, I digress. So my drugs and alcohol talk, I really embrace it because I share with students. And of course, it's modified for audience appropriateness because I started smoking pot when I was in fifth, sixth grade. So when I speak to kids who are in fifth, sixth grade, I don't mention the fact that I used to do a lot of cocaine and used to hang off of elevators upside down, elevator shafts and things of that nature, because that is way too much detail, way too advanced and way too scary for them to digest and to comprehend. So, but I will tell them things of nature that I did start smoking pot at your age, and this is the reasons why I did it, and give them all the things that was the gateway drug. That's all I'll say, is that it starts from that point on and can get worse, and talks go on, and I keep it very appropriate. And when you go into the high school level or eighth grade, seventh and eighth grade, it gets a little bit more open. College, high school, full-blown. College, et cetera, full-blown as well. Nothing really spared in terms of the content, just the presentation. So I spoke to a client the other day, or a potential client. They called me and said, listen, we'd love to speak to you about drugs and alcohol. I said, great. A lot of the clients that you've seen on my website have a lot of great positive things to say about it. I can't say it's a scared straight thing, but it does give people the reality of what happens when you partake in, you know, excessive drinking. I mean, everyone's going to drink and try alcohol. And depending on the venue and or audience, I can say that, listen, we know you're going to drink. We know a portion of you, a certain percentage of you are going to try to recreate in drugs. But here's what happens when it goes further and past that. And I tell my stories. And so this potential client called me up and we're talking on the phone, very, very affable person. And they said, I've read your website and you have a very interesting past, and certainly with the drugs and alcohol, a lot of experience, and your lot of stories are interesting, compelling, but very checkered. And so in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, where is this going? So they said they'd love to have me speak at their high school, but they don't want me to share. They don't want me to share my personal stories of what I did and how I acted and performed and how I almost, you know, killed myself accidentally just because I was, you know, totally inebriated, or people I was with, or I almost got killed because I was with people who were inebriated and they were doing idiotic things. So they're talking on and on. I said, okay, you know, are you available this date and that date? So I said, excuse me, I had to interrupt you that I just want to confirm that you don't want me to share my personal stories. They said, no. I said, can I ask you why? And they said, well, we feel that if you share your stories about doing cocaine, mushrooms, but, you know, that was the big thing was drinking and cocaine. Pot was the gateway drug. That we feel that, yeah, you did all those crazy things and you survived and you became a New York City radio broadcaster. You speak all over the country to audiences. You're, you know, a success. So we think if you come in here and tell our students that, then that's okay, because then they can be, they can turn out all right, just like you did. And I said, well, you know, I think you're kind of undercutting and shortchanging your students and how smart they are, because you have to understand the consequences of something to do or not to do to make a choice in life. And that applies to anything. With drugs and alcohol, absolutely. I know somebody who went into, I don't know the actual terminology, we'll call it a youth detention center, ages 13 to 18. And they said to me, I said, how'd it go? And they're like, oh, it was cool, man. The kids are really, really attentive. And the takeaway for my friend who's a speaker said that they never had anyone in their life come to their school or police athletic association, whatever the platform may be, and say, if you do drugs, if you drink excessively, if you do X, this is what potentially could happen to you. They said, in a collective voice, they said, this never was presented to us. And if this would have been part of our education, chances are we wouldn't be sitting in a cell and or locked up doing time. Hopefully they're getting out when they're 18, or possibly some of them are going to be going to a full-blown prison. So that was reverberating in the back of my mind when I was talking to this client, saying they don't want me to share my story. So P.S., I very professionally and with lots of decorum said, I'm not going to work for you, dude, because I can't be myself. I think, and I could easily go in front of an audience and not share all my details of all the drugs I did and how I almost T-boned a policeman in his unmarked police car who was in a median, and I didn't even have a driver's license, and I was completely annihilated, or how I hung on the I-beam of an elevator shaft while an elevator went up and down, or how I drove all the time without a license, inebriated. How I almost took my life and multiple lives numerous times, countless times, driving a motorcycle, driving anything you think of, even walking, even a bicycle. I've flipped over cars being totally inebriated and having a visual impairment, not seeing them coming home from a bar. I've pretty much done it, you know, intoxicated or high on drugs. So yes, I could give a talk about leaving out my experiences, but would it be effective as a talk including all the examples of all the idiotic, stupid, and that's the only time I like to use the word stupid is when I'm talking about myself in this particular instance, stupid actions that I did. So he was respectful, I guess. I mean, he sounded pretty cool about it and said, you know, if you need something in the future, or if I can include my talks, you know, with these stories, or if you want me to talk about the other things I talk about, anti-bullying, overcoming adversity, things of that nature, I'd be happy to come to your school. But at this present time, I don't think it's going to work. And that's kind of how it ended. On another very cool a note, though, I should say, on a very cooler note, I was on a stage back in September down in Trenton, New Jersey, the keynote at a parade, the Disability Pride Parade in Trenton, New Jersey, which is kind of cool because it's right outside the governor's office. And a lot of big names were in attendance. The commissioner of healthcare for New Jersey, and all these other heads of commissioners of different offices and corporate officials, et cetera. So when I got off the stage, and I love performing in this crowd, it's a great, great effervescence, very motivated crowd and audience. I got off the stage and someone came up to me and said, hey, we really liked your speech and your entertainment value, et cetera, and you have a lot of great points. Do you have a card? And so I gave this person a card. And this person was incredibly well-spoken, articulate, put together, dressed, you name it. And so I said, oh, where are you from? They said, oh, Princeton University. I'm like, oh, great. In my mind, I'm like, oh, I'd love to speak at Princeton University. And I got pulled aside by someone else. I turned around and they were gone. But P.S., someone reached out to me. And I spoke at the PDA, the Princeton Disability Awareness Conference, 2 weeks ago. And it was really, really interesting because I was able to speak to mostly parents. And I've spoken to parents many, many times, but mostly it's on a overcoming adversity aspect and not so much focused totally only on disability. So it was a great avenue to share my experience of growing up with a disability, having parents treating me the same as my other four siblings, and the dialogue that we would have or not have because I was treated the same. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, how I coped being in school, being treated differently by administrators, by teachers, and by students, and what kind of impact it had on me. So I want to thank Princeton University for having me. I'd love to come back in the future, and I think that's a consideration for an event they're having next year. And also to all the parents in attendance, because they couldn't have been more giving, and I got a lot from them, which is also very nice. And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to mention to you something very interesting, because when we think about, you know, if you're not a parent, maybe you're going to be a parent, or maybe you just know parents or young parents. And when you think about, you know, when it's time to have the talk is what? The talk could be like several different things nowadays. The talk is like, you know, stay away from drugs and alcohol. Depending on your age, of course, you would introduce this conversation, the birds and the bees. And of course, you think about appropriateness, you know. A six-year-old and a three-year-old. A three-year-old doesn't have, we haven't had this conversation with, but in terms of inappropriate touch, being alone with an adult, not keeping secrets, you have to worry about that, of course. And I'm sure you've had that conversation if your kid is around four or five, six. But the other thing I'm thinking about is now we have to have a conversation, dialogue, which I started the other day with my son, about all the school shootings. It's crazy, right? I mean, he came home last year and said, yeah, Dad, we had a lockdown today. And I didn't want my face to really show that I was freaked out that we had a lockdown. But they had a lockdown. And, you know, they don't know anything different. And I guess it's not really much different from, like, World War II when we used to have air bomb drills. But it's a whole different world and a whole different violent society. And I guess the conduit of the horrific nature in which we're dealing with. So that's kind of where I want to leave it. And it's kind of, you know, running out of time, and I was going to have a psychologist on today to share that. And we're going to continue this dialogue in the next show or two. But just wanted to put that out there. I did have a dialogue saying, listen, there are some people in this world that aren't good people, no matter where they live in life. But the great people in life far, far, far outweigh the not so great people. And unfortunately, we just have to take, you know, practice and do things to prepare for things like fire, if you ever have a firehouse, fire in a school, you know, emergency drills. But this will never, ever happen to your school, I'm assuring my son. But if anything ever did, you'd be smart enough and know exactly what to do. That's it for Insight. PRN continues. Gary Knowles next. The founder and the person who's a chef around here each and every day, bringing us all lunch. Love to hear from you next week. So check in, of course, his show. And all my shows are available at podcasts. Always check it out. Mark Farrell, have a great day no matter where you are. And talk to you next Thursday. Enjoy.